mortality risk goes down dramatically from birth to about 10 to 14 years old. That's the lowest all-cause mortality is when you're basically just a teenager. And then it pretty closely linearly increases for every year that we're alive after that. So if we know all of these biomarkers of as many organ systems as possible, instead of seeing that linear increase for mortality risk, can we flatten it? If we can flatten it, for how long, right? 50 years, 20 years?
Welcome to the Siim Lund podcast. My name is Siim Lund, and today our guest is Dr. Michael Lustgarden. Michael has a PhD in exercise physiology and is one of the world's leading experts in self-quantification and biological aging. Michael has an amazing YouTube channel called Conquer Aging or Die Trying, where he shares the latest research on longevity and also shows his personal experimentations. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Siim.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you back on the show. It's your third time. And I always think of, you know, what are the guests I bring to the show? It's always people I'm like most interested in talking at that moment. So you have a lot of this. I think you're the one of the like really original, let's say, not biohackers, but more of like the guy who tracks all the biomarkers. Like, you've been doing this for, you know, over 10 years of tracking all your food and tracking all your biomarkers several times a year. So you have, at least for yourself, you have pretty much a ton of data about what kind of supplements, what kind of foods and exercise affect your biomarkers and how it correlates with your speed of aging and longevity overall. So yeah, I'm happy to pick your brain about, in this episode we'll be focusing mostly on like nutrition and the diet and how it like affects these biomarkers that are linked to mortality or longevity.
I'm not the only one, right? So you've recently met Joe Cohen too. So he's been deep in the game for a long time too. And probably even more in some ways with, the blood testing, right? So he's got his panelists, not to give South Dakota a shout out, but or to give them a shout out, but their panel is extensive and exhaustive. And I wouldn't say that if it wasn't true, right? So and I see you jumping, in that group too. So, we're a small but evolving group of people who are, trying to optimize their way to maximum health and longevity through objective biomarker tracking.
Mm. Yeah. So maybe we can start with what is your philosophy, or how do you look at it, like tracking biomarkers, and how would you in the world of nutrition, there's so much noise and so much like conflicting information. Like, one week you hear on the headlines that eggs are great for you, and the other next week it says even one egg is as bad as smoking a pack of cigarettes. So there's a lot of people obviously being very confused about that. So what's your philosophy or view on this?
Yeah, so it isn't just that side of it. The other side of it too is based on animal studies and randomized controlled trials in people, in other people. Many people in the, pro longevity or wanting to slow aging space will say, I'm going to take X, Y, or Z supplement, or I'm going to do this to my diet because of studies in other people and studies in animal models of longevity, but never actually testing themselves to see if that intervention or interventions is a negative, neutral, or actually a positive, right? So for the longest time, as you mentioned, I've been looking at looking at biomarkers of kidney function, liver function, immune cells, inflammation, metabolic health, the full spectrum, blood pressure, lung function, based on the premise that if I track these things for a very long time, not only will I discover the diet, exercise, supplement, and in some cases, supplement and sleep approach that can minimize mortality risk and potentially maximize my longevity, but if I do end up with a disease, I should be able to catch it earlier rather than I've got some pathology that's been happening for 20 years. And it's like, where did this come from? Right. So, And then not just that, knowing how my body reacts to certain foods or certain supplements that may guide whatever therapies if some adverse health condition does come up. So the crux of my approach, besides, testing, tracking, intervention, and repeat, which I call the F around, find out approach, is mortality risk goes down dramatically from birth to about 10 to 14 years old. That's the lowest all-cause mortality is when you're basically just a teenager. And then it pretty closely linearly increases for every year that we're alive after that.
Right.
So if we know, you know, all of these biomarkers of as many organ systems as possible, instead of seeing that linear increase for mortality risk, can we flatten it? And if we can flatten it, for how long, right? 50 years, 20 years? So that's the crux of my my approach.
Mm. Yeah, like age, chronological age is the biggest risk factor for virtually, yeah, like all diseases and, you know, deaths as well. So, and when you are, you know, a teenager or even in your early 20s, then your a lot of the biomarkers are pretty much optimal as they'll ever be at that time frame. And, you know, at least in for me as well, it makes sense that, you know, if you maintain those same biomarkers into your 40s and 50s and 60s and even beyond that, then yeah, like you are effectively quote-unquote slowing down aging, or at least you're minimizing the risk of a lot of the chronic diseases that, you know, kill people prematurely.
100%. So also along those lines is, I don't presume that this will stop aging, but so like you said, when you're in your 20s, you should expect to have all these biomarkers of multiple organ systems as, you know, as close to optimal as possible, right? So, but aging is going to happen, right? Just entropy, you know, all we can do at best is to slow it, right? It's the live long enough to live forever approach. So, you know, there may be processes that you wouldn't catch right away that we're not measuring, right? And with that in mind, let's say, you know, you hit your early 30s, you start to see some changes that weren't going on in your early 20s, right? So then the challenge, and this is one of the reasons why I track as many variables as I can, is, all right, I'm starting to see these changes just that out of nowhere. What can I tweak in my approach to bring them back to youthful? And not just improve those biomarkers, but the net sum. And, you know, I liken this to the equalizers on a stereo. You know, it's like, you know, you move one thing for a certain sound and then you move another thing. It's not as simple as do one intervention, fix one biomarker, nothing else changes. It's a constant tweaking of, yeah, I need to get as many of these things back to where they should be. And it's not a perfect system. It's a constant trial and error process, right? And we're fighting against it, you know, through various means, exercise, supplements, you know, tweaking the diet. So,
Yeah, it's like, yeah, if you do one thing, like you go on a specific diet, you might see one biomarker improving, like your blood sugar improves, but your, you know, lipids might get worse, or your visceral fat gets worse, or whatever it is. So yeah, like you have to pretty much look at all the main, most important biomarkers and not look at it in isolation, so to say. Because yeah, you know, you might not die to, you know, let's say diabetes, but you might still get heart disease, or you might still get neurodegeneration, whatever it is. So like, you know, there's, at least there's, you know, the World Health Organization lists the top 10 causes of death worldwide, but, you know, there could be like many additional ones, as and they all kind of contribute to each other in some shape or form.
Yeah. So I think a lot of the field is focused on, and especially if you listen to, you know, I won't name names, but, you know, muscle is the organ of longevity, that crowd, which I don't dispute that, right? But when we talk about longevity, it's an increase in average lifespan. But nonetheless, if you're going to, you know, you're regularly exercising and, you know, you're going to maximize muscle mass, maximize muscle function, you'd predict that your metabolic health, insulin sensitivity will be low, which is great, which is fantastic. But as you mentioned, are your lipids going to put you at lower risk of heart disease, right? You know, and what does kidney function show? What does liver health show, right? The idea that being lean and fit is the elixir for all organ systems, I don't buy that. And I've seen cases where, you know, people will focus on one thing and then they'll have other systems that are just completely out of whack, like normal glucose, normal lipids, and immune cells, like total white blood cells that are like 11, just outrageously high. You know, so we can have selective impairments in certain organ systems and not even know it for decades. Or there's the other crowd where, you know, for kidney function, for example, they'll say, oh, my kidney function is fine. Yeah, based on a normal range, but is it youthful, right? Is it what you'd expect to find in someone in a 20-year-old and your chronological age is 50 or older, right? So most people, it's not even on their radar, unfortunately. Underrated, right? Kidney and liver and all these other things are completely underrated.
Yeah, exactly. And like you said, you want to pretty much aim for a lower biological age with your biomarkers than your chronological age is. So like, yeah, like what's normal, you don't want to be like what's normal for your age. You want to be better than that. You want to be, quote unquote, with a younger biological age for that biomarker. So like, you know, you want to have the lipids and the immune cells of a 20-year-old rather than a 60-year-old.
Yeah, but note that even like using Levine's PhenoAge, which is pretty much amongst the best for blood-based biological age calculators in terms of its correlation with chronological age and all-cause mortality risk, it's got blind spots, right? It doesn't include blood pressure, doesn't include lung function. And these are two variables that are, that decline, you know, systolic blood pressure increases during aging and FEV1 as a measure of lung expiratory strength. That declines during aging. So those are two major organ systems, right, that are completely ignored by that tool, right? And then Dunedin pace, which is the epigenetic pace of aging, doesn't necessarily correlate with my Levine test, which covers, you know, albumin and inflammation, glucose, many organ systems. Those data are somewhat disparate in my data. So there may be molecular mechanisms in terms of biological aging that are not captured if we're only looking at one metric of quote unquote biological age. So I think the most reasonable choice is to look at many different measures, you know, the molecular markers of biological age, metabolite markers that can be related to biological age, like whole metabolite profiling, and then some of the bigger picture, like cells, white blood cells, red blood cells, proteins, albumin, you know, so looking at it from the molecular, epigenetic to, you know, up every level as we can get, right? With the highest level being physiological function, right? So,
Yeah.
Optimizing it every step above that way.
Yeah. Obviously, you could go crazy with all the markers as well. Like, there's literally hundreds of them that you could track. What do you think are like the, you know, like tier one and tier two or three kind of markers?
Yeah. So the lowest hanging fruit is eat real food and exercise, right? That's without any tracking. And then above that, leanness and making sure you avoid functional decline. So those two are probably going to link with metabolic health and a whole bunch of other stuff, assuming you're eating real food and exercise, right? But then, so then taking it the step further, the lowest hanging fruit in terms of testing would probably just be a standard chemistry panel and complete metabolic count, you know, CBC, complete blood chemistry. So those two tests, it's a $35 test USD. It covers all of the basics, you know, kidney function, liver function, red and white blood cells and their differentials. That gives you a lot of information from multiple organ systems at a relatively low cost. And then taking that a step further, blood pressure and lung function, you know, FEV1, just a simple spirometer, $100 or so USD. You don't need anything fancy. And, you know, blood pressure cuff, that doesn't have to be anything fancy. But then taking it towards the molecular and metabolite levels, you know, the epigenetics would be as molecular as you get, at least, the, you know, Horvath and Dunedin pace. Horvath being how old are you, but it's not the best for all-cause mortality risk. And Dunedin pace, you know, with it's not the best for how old are you, but it's amongst the best for all-cause mortality risk and potentially the best for the speed, epigenetic speed of aging. In terms of metabolites, looking at, you know, somewhat obscure metabolite classes like cholesterol esters, which have been recently linked with a quote-unquote healthy lifestyle, i.e. not smoking, lean BMI, healthy diet. And I have a video on my channel where I recently covered that analysis. So cholesterol esters being cholesterol bound to certain fatty acids. But then other things like kynurenine divided by tryptophan, which are an integrated measure of pro and anti-inflammatory markers. So there are a lot of layers, you know, that one can go after on that path. For sure.
This episode is brought to you by Bone Charge, my favorite company for blue blocking glasses, red light therapy devices, and red light bulbs. These items are essential for keeping your sleep-wakefulness cycles aligned in a world that tries to mess them up. Instead of looking at your phone before bed and letting the blue light disrupt your melatonin production, why not wear blue blockers instead that prevent that from happening? Instead of having your bedroom lit up with bright lights, use the more sleep-friendly alternative by opting for flicker-free red light bulbs that don't disrupt your sleep. Bone Charge also has amazing infrared sauna blankets that can give you the same health benefits as the traditional sauna. You also get the unique benefits of infrared light that improves joint and skin health. Head over to bonecharge.com/seamlund and use the code SEAM, S-I-I-M, for a 15% discount.
But we can maybe now transition to talking about the diet. Obviously, diet has a huge impact on our health and biomarkers as well. So what do you, based on, like, first we can maybe start with, like, based on the epidemiology and clinical studies, what's, like, generally associated with lower speed of aging and longer, let's say, youth, as well as, like, just reduced mortality? And then we can transition to, like, what's your data, like, what have you found individually?
Yeah, so in terms of the epidemiological stuff, I haven't looked too much because there just isn't that much data for the epigenetic pace of aging. There's maybe two studies in very small sample sizes, but epidemiologically, you know, it's what we would all expect. And, right. You know, the carnivore crowd is going to hate my guts for saying it. And I'm not opposed to any diet can potentially be good for biomarkers. It's just show me the data. So I'm not trying to, you know, what the published data shows up to now is eat lots of fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, you know, less red meat, more fish. I mean, these are the standards based on the large epidemiological. Yeah,
Mediterranean style diet.
But even Mediterranean is somewhat of it's a romanticized diet. Like, there are RCTs that intended on giving one group a Mediterranean diet and the other ate, you know, just whatever. And it was like a one-year RCT that I have in mind. And after 1 year of being on the quote-unquote Mediterranean diet, fiber intake across both groups wasn't different, right? And they were looking for gut microbiome changes. So they had to evaluate, you know, the whole cohort as a, you know, were there changes in the microbiome based on people who adhered to the Mediterranean diet versus lower adherence? So long story short there is, even what's on a quote-unquote Mediterranean diet is somewhat romanticized. The romanticism that comes with that is that people may be just eating less junk, less ultra processed food. And that may be some of the explanation for some of the health promoting effects that they claim. Because it's not like a 70 fiber per gram, you know, per day diet. That's when I think of the Mediterranean diet, you're eating real food and an abundance of fruits and vegetables. Your fiber intake should be sky high, but there's no data that any Mediterranean diet has gotten above like 40 grams per day. So,
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. The, at least like in the RCTs, most of the RCTs do find that it improves like the risk factors and also linked to lower heart disease and neurodegeneration and those kind of things.
But I don't dispute that a Mediterranean diet versus someone's standard American diet, which is just chips and soda and all this other garbage, is going to be better. But how much of the Mediterranean diet is related to just eating less ultra processed food? That's the only thing I, you know, even the idea of, and I guess, you know, well, anyway, it is what it is. The idea that olive oil is this elixir of health, I think that's flawed data too. And that's a big part in quotes of the Mediterranean diet. What if, and I may have mentioned this before, but what if an equivalent amount of olives, the whole food, was replacing that olive oil? I'd expect that the biggest effect should be there. Like imagine if I said, I'm going to give you this strawberry sugar and it's going to be great for your health relative to just pure glucose.
Mm.
I could phrase it as differently. I'd say, I'm going to give you this strawberry sugar and it's not going to raise your insulin, right? So you'd say, oh, it's great, you know, but it's fructose, right? Fructose goes straight to the liver. It shouldn't increase insulin, right? But if I gave you strawberries, which now have the full complement of all the nutrition, the insulin spike you'd get, if at all, probably far less. Anyway, it's when it comes to olive oil and the Mediterranean diet, I see it in the same way. It's like clever marketing, and you know, the real control is olives. Give me 200 calories of olives versus 200 calories of olive oil, which is going to come out on top.
Mm-hmm. Right. Have you looked at your own data from there, comparing the two?
How do you mean?
Or I mean, have you done the test in yourself of eating 200 calories of olives versus olive oil?
I haven't, only because, you know, 200 calories of pure oil. I'm not trying to ruin my physiology, you know, for the sake of science, right? So, but it seems like it'd be an obvious, and then it's like, are you measuring all the things, you know, if you only look at in isolation, a few biomarkers, that olive oil could be better than whole olives, but would the full panel be better? I mean, I find it hard to believe that a food processing product would be better than the whole food. If that were the case, we wouldn't eat anything. We'd just be eating Soylent, right? So
So we talked about the epidemiological studies with the disease and longevity. So what is your own personal data say?
Right. So I should say that my current diet has evolved out of following the biomarkers. In 2015, I started off raw vegan. That wasn't good for triglycerides and HDL, which went in the wrong directions. My HDL had been at low, as low at that time as 28. My triglycerides, which weren't terribly high, went from like 50 to 90. So then once I added fish back in, those got a little bit better, but still not great, especially for HDL. And so the long story short is, in terms of macros, I'm at about 40-ish percent fat, which includes about 9% coming from fiber. So fiber can be fermented into short-chain fatty acids by the gut microbiome, which you can add to total fat. So my diet's about 40 to 45% fat, 38-ish or so from carbs, net carbs, and then around 18 or 19% from total protein. So, but I didn't settle on those data arbitrarily. It's just, you know, it's through that process of like 50 blood tests over the past 9 years or so, where I've had, you know, fat intakes that are 30 to 40 grams higher than now, and looking at the biomarkers, all right, the net effect isn't positive. Protein intakes that are 40 to 50 grams higher than now, it wasn't great for my biomarkers either. So, but then on the other side, I've had protein intakes as low as 70 grams per day. So it's a matter of, you know, finding the bottom of the U shape, where, you know, the amount of protein, carbs, fat, fiber, even fiber has been as high as 120 grams per day, whereas now it's about 85 to 90. So for me, it's been about finding the U shape of the curve to, you know, optimize as many biomarkers as possible. So that's the gross macros. In terms of what foods are in there, it's fish every day. I eat sardines. I'm generally not lazy when it comes to food prep, but food prep on its own is probably an hour and a half a day. And I'm not trying to wait 40 minutes for salmon to cook every day and clean the oven. I just don't want to do that. So sardines every day, you know, nuts, almonds, walnuts, peanuts are in there every day. Lots of vegetables, lots of fruit too. I mean, it's probably 20 to 30 servings of fruit and vegetable per day. But then even then I'm doing little experiments to try to improve some of the weak spots in my data. Like my Horvath epigenetic age is not great. My Dunedin paste needs some work too. And homocysteine also needs some work. So I've got some issues with methylation that I'm trying to increase methyl donors first by diet before I go to other, you know, other means.
Mm. Gotcha. Yeah. One question about the finding the U shape is that, you know, I would presume that your health was still great with, you know, going from like changing your carbohydrate intake by 30 grams or changing your fat intake by 30 grams, because the diet was probably like very similar and you just adjusted some of the macros to find the sweet spot. So I would just imagine that you were already like in excellent health compared to like the traditional regular person. You were just optimizing it to the like, yeah, last percentages.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. You know, but it becomes a question of what if I was making all these dietary changes and didn't measure at all, right? And I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't even, you know, ideally what's the word I'm looking for? You know, we could simulate, you know, all right, this is my diet. This is my genetic code. This is my microbiome. They're, you know, microbiome genetics. We put in all those factors and what, you know, if I eat this diet for X amount of years, based on the current published data for the genetics of disease and everything else, when would I get disease, right? Ideally, we'd be able to sim, right? We'd sim all this stuff out. But so I'm doing it in the short case where, you know, just using it as an example, higher fat diet in my case. And again, this is whole food. It's not seed oil. Seed oils have almost never been a part of the approach for the past, you know, since 2015. Glucose was like in the 90s, glucose increases during aging for like 15 or 18 tests in a row when I was higher fat, like, you know, 120 grams per day versus now where it's closer to around 80 to 90. Once I saw that data in my correlations, I cut the fat back down to around 80 to 85. Problem solved. Glucose has never been, you know, that high. So, or as high as it was. So it goes to that point, like, you know, you were saying I was in probably good health, but if I continued on that trend, for whatever reason, in my case, higher, you know, most people hear higher fat was bad for your glucose. They're like, that doesn't make sense. Yeah. But if someone's eating junk and they cut their, you know, they go higher fat. Well, maybe they cut the junk out and now their glucose improved. But anyway, so what I'm trying to say is that, you know, I would need to sim it where, you know, with that higher fat diet for me and glucose perpetually in the 90s, would it have made my insulin sensitivity worse 30 years from now versus getting it back into the 80 to 90-ish range where glucose has not been in the 90s since then? How would that look physiologically 30 years from now? I don't have the answer, right? But all I can do is place the bets based on the, you know, all-cause mortality data.
Yeah, it's like we'd need like AI to do the simulation and like this lifelong simulation. But even then, the AI is only as good as the data that it gets. So if we were to have perfect data about, like these are the lowest risks of mortality, etc., and these are the genetic things we know affect this process, then the AI would work. But, you know, we necessarily... It's hard to yell at because we don't have perfect data about what's the actual complete lowest risk of mortality for whatever biomarker or for whatever diet or anything else or for whatever genetics. It's very complex, is what I'm saying.
No doubt. And probably in the beginning, the AI wouldn't be great, but that constant iteration of, okay, every, you know, 7 tests a year or however many tests that I'm doing in a few years, you know, it's constantly being reiterated with the AI, right? And, you know, it should get better with its predictions over time. And now, granted, maybe 50 years of predictions using whatever that AI is giving me, maybe that's not the best. And then people can, if I do die, then people can pick up that torch and say, all right, this is what he did. We need to refine it and we can improve our models, right? So eventually someone's going to have it figured out.
Yeah, it's going to take a few guinea pigs.
Literally, right?
How do you know, like, okay, this is the food that actually like moves the needle on this marker or something? How do you control for those things? Because, you know, that you could also like sleep worse, or you could exercise differently, or take a different supplement or whatever.
Yeah, so I track all that. I track sleep. I track, you know, fitness markers, including the average daily heart rate. And there is some evidence to that, where, you know, if you're more active, you're going to have a higher average daily heart rate chronically. And then I look at the average daily heart rate in conjunction with a blood test. So in other words, if I have a 50-day period in between tests, test one, test two, and I know the average daily heart rate in between that 50 days, that 50-day average corresponds to the latter blood test. So with enough blood tests, or even, you know, blood pressure or lung function, whatever variable that I'm looking at, because I'm lining up that average measure of activity with a biomarker, I can look at correlations and see, all right, is it too much activity during this period that may have contributed to some adverse biomarker profile? Or if that's not the case, what other variables are significantly correlated with the biomarkers? Now, even there's going to be noise, especially when one doesn't have a lot of their own biomarker data. But I mean, with a constant iteration over and over of, okay, 20 tests in, I've tried, you know, it's constantly trying the top correlations. And after many tests, you start to get towards what's the truth. Now, also, there's a lot of standardization that goes into, you know, before every test. So, for example, you know, I'll do my last workout on a Friday before a Monday test. So I've got at least 2 days of, you know, somewhat rest and recovery. On the morning of the test, 20 ounces of water, 2 to 2.5 hours before every test. So now I'm hydrated. Hydration is not going to be, you know, or lack of hydration is not going to be a negative influence on the biomarkers. So standardizing, and then even the diet on the day before. Now, granted, I'm tracking everything, you know, every day, but the diet on the day before, I don't want that to be so much variability that maybe that imparts variability on the biomarkers. So I'm pretty close to standardize my intake for that, you know, day before for every test going back. So now it's not the day before diet that impacted the biomarkers. It's, you know, what is the average intake for that period, or even average activity level, average sleep. I have all of that data where I can look at it in conjunction with the biomarkers.
Gotcha.
I've even started to look at things like wake events during the night, which you know, it provides, and looking at correlations in my data to see if there's anything that I can do to minimize that, potentially improving, you know, sleep duration and sleep quality.
Gotcha. Your protein intake you mentioned was like, how much was it? Like 19% or something like that?
Yep. It's about 100 grams per day. 1.5 something grams per kilogram, which is close to that Stu Phillips meta-analysis of maximizing muscle mass as a result of regular strength training. But I'm thinking about going higher again, and but slow increments, because I don't want to mess up a whole bunch of other biomarkers to improve one or two.
Right. What have you seen from your data? Like, okay, how does protein affect your biomarkers? Like, what has led you to the conclusion that this 19 spot is right now good, and what happens if you take it too high?
Yeah, so the 100 grams per day, in my case, around 100 grams per day, just using Levine's PhenoAge as an example, it's a part of that approach. And on my last test, it was 19 and a half years younger than my chronological. And remember, that's the integration of multiple organ systems. And that's my best ever data over 30 something tests, right? So I can't say that's causative, but it's a part of the approach that helps me keep that mostly youthful biomarker profile. When I went higher, just using glucose as an example, that's one of the biomarkers too that for whatever reason went in the wrong direction. I'd have to pull up my data to go through the full list, but I have that data, but it was more biomarkers going in the wrong direction than right on a panel of about 25 biomarkers of multiple organ systems.
Okay, gotcha. A lot of one of the biggest thing that people say about protein is the kidney function, that too much protein is going to be harmful for the kidneys. Did you see anything like that in your data?
I didn't for that, but actually there's a third rung of that tier, which is the gut. So what most people probably don't know is that very high protein diets, if your body isn't using it, for protein synthesis or whatever it needs, it's just going to take off the amino group and reformulate it into urea for excretion. So sure, if you have poor kidney function, urea is going to accumulate. But that doesn't necessarily imply, direct correlation between protein intake with reduced kidney function. But where urea gets interesting, besides its own all-cause mortality data showing that above, I think, 17 milligrams per deciliter increased all-cause mortality risk, urea at about 20 milligrams per deciliter can impair intestinal tight junctions, meaning it can degrade the barrier in between intestinal epithelial cells, making it easier for stuff that's in the intestinal lumen to leak into the blood, potentially activating inflammation and other, pathways that aren't going to be good for health. So now granted, my BUN as a marker of protein intake is nowhere near that 17 milligrams per deciliter. It's about half that. So I do have some room to play with in terms of, how much protein can my body actually utilize where it doesn't negatively impact intestinal barrier function. So I look at it from that perspective, too much protein, potentially worse intestinal gut barrier function, and that can impact kidney function. There is a gut-kidney axis that most people probably don't know about. Actually, it's in my book from, the 2016 that put a lot of that data in there.
Right. Yeah. The protein mostly can be harmful for people who have suboptimal kidney function. And there are some mechanistic reasons that, theoretically, at least, if you are healthy, then maybe excess protein intake for the rest of your life, this bodybuilder protein intake for the rest of your life, probably eventually will have some sort of negative effect on the kidneys, decades later. But yeah, we don't necessarily know that.
But even without the kidneys, there is a trade-off there, right? So if you look at the animal models, protein restriction extends lifespan. Or methionine restriction is one example. I think even there's a leucine or one of the branched chain amino acid restriction too in a recent study, extended lifespan, granted in cage-fed sedentary mice, right? So, but then the other side of that coin, like you mentioned, these bodybuilder 1 to 3 gram per pound of body weight, not grams per kilogram, and there's no published data, that shows, these very high levels are maximizing muscle mass. But I look at it from the other side of it is how can we titrate what is optimal for protein intake? And if your blood urea nitrogen is trending high, probably it's too much. But then even then it's like, all right, how much BUN should I carry where it's not going to be negative for my, systemic physiology, while at the same time optimizing muscle mass, with protein intake.
Yeah. And blood sugar as well can, at least based on your data, it increased, right? If you had too much protein.
It was protein intake is significantly correlated with higher glucose in my data. Yeah. So, and high fat too. So,
gotcha. And the protein, when we're talking about protein, so you say like you eat fish every day. What's the rationale for that in your, let's say, experience?
Omega-3s, you know, EPA and DHA decline during aging in blood plasma levels. That's associated with an increased all-cause mortality risk. Is that because older people are eating less fatty fish? I don't know. Is that because there's increased inflammation, and inflammation leads to degradation of EPA and DHA? So there's less of that now systemically, probably. So I'm trying to look at it from both angles, where I want to give my physiology and biochemistry enough of it dietarily, but then also I'm tracking their levels in blood. So if there is any, you know, degradation, I can look at what's correlated with that degradation and try to minimize that too.
Mm. Yeah. And obviously many people will just ask as well, like, what's the thing with meat and your biomarkers as well, or just, you know, what do you think about meat and the longevity side? Because we already mentioned some of the methionine aspect as well.
So beef has been a part of my diet, and actually its net correlative score with about those 25 biomarkers is positive. It's got, if off the top of my head, it's like a +2 or +4, meaning 2 to 4 biomarkers going in the right direction relative to how many are going in the wrong. But sardines have like a +8 score. So that's one way. So for me, it's sardines seem to be better. And even eggs are either neutral or +1, some very small positive correlative effect. And actually I've added eggs back in for my next test. And that's along the Dunedin pay story, but we can get into that, you know, a bit later. But people have asked, like, okay, why don't you add beef in addition to the sardines, or add eggs in addition? And there's only so many calories that go around. Like, you know, my average calorie intake right now is around, you know, 2080 per day. And even to add things in, I've got to take stuff out that I like, or it's getting very difficult to find the calories to add this stuff in. I like beef, I'm not anti-beef, I'm not anti-meat by any means. You know, but it's just a matter of, you know, satiety. I like sardines too. I look forward to it every day. The biomarkers may be better with fish in my diet relative to beef. And I just don't have calories to add it in anywhere else.
Yeah. It's like there's only so many superfoods you can add before they actually start to have, yeah, like a negative effect because of the excess calorie, component. So you have to pick your like, battles, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. And interestingly, whey protein has been in my approach too. And as I mentioned, one of my weak spots is homocysteine. Now, one of the things that's significantly correlated with lower homocysteine in my data, which is currently age expected, which those words are like stabbing me in the back to hear anything age expected, higher protein. In my case, when my protein intakes have been closer to 140 grams per day, homocysteine was like 7 micromolar, whereas now it's closer to 10, 10 and a half, 11 micromolar.
Mm.
But then that's only one biomarker. The majority of biomarkers on higher protein, not good. So a part of that story is whey. For whatever reason, higher whey intakes in my case are significantly correlated with lower homocysteine. But it goes back to, like you were saying, there's only so much room. And if I was going to include whey, now that's 80 calories per day, 20 grams more protein. Where am I going to get that from? And I can hear people saying, take this out, take that out. Don't eat any vegetables. Oh, okay, fine. But that's not, you know, I'm not trying to ruin this.
What about more exercise? Like you can do 80 calories more walking or cardio?
Yeah, I wish I could say that every minute of my activity was geared specifically towards exercise and very little wasted on like emotional stress, work stress, you know, non-function improving activity. For example, if I go for a, you know, a walk, sure, I'm going to get some baseline improvements, but for that 20 minutes, I could be doing HIIT, but I can't do HIIT because I need to take those 20 minutes on a recovery day to, you know, improve recovery from the 90-minute workout the day before. So I've got my exercise dose, my prescription there pretty close to optimal too. Just as an example, I know your heart rate variability, resting heart rate combination is something like 100 over 40, right? 100 for heart rate variability average, right? Somewhere in that ballpark. 2 days ago.
HRV is, like over 100, and resting heart rate is like 38 or maybe 40 at most.
2 days ago, my heart rate variability was 82, resting heart rate 39. Mm. And I'm 25, 24 years chronologically older. So, but that's because I'm playing with the dose of exercise and how much I'm doing in the recovery days. I'm using like a heart rate variability, resting heart rate guided training, you know, to guide me when and how often and the duration, intensity. When it comes to adding more exercise, in my case, on top of what I'm already doing, it doesn't make my data worse, unfortunately for me. And that's, I say unfortunately for me because mentally, I've got like the Conor McGregor level delusion of, I think I'm gorilla. I can just train for hours like I used to, but my data just, my data just gets wrecked if I do that. So I can't push. Right now I can. If I didn't have all of the other non-fitness improving time spent away from exercise, if I didn't have that, I could spend more time doing it without impairing my data and potentially improving my metrics where I'd be able to add that. But unless I leave academia at some point in the next year, year and a half, that's going to be a challenge.
Right. Yeah, gotcha. Like you eat meat sometimes, or what about plant-based proteins as well? Like, do you eat any beans or legumes? And what do you think about that?
Yeah, so chickpeas are a regular part of the diet now. I added them for a couple tests. I took them out for many tests, and then I added them back in. And they're a part of that 19 and a half year reduction for Levine's test. And they may actually be improving my creatinine marker, kidney function, EGFR. I've seen my two best EGFRs using creatinine, which I know it's not the best measure, but even cystatin C is 0.71, which is, what you'd expect to find in someone in their 20s and 30s. So chickpeas are now a regular part of the diet, but in order to get them in, I had to take out barley and oats, which I like. Chickpeas are a regular part of the diet. I can't go too crazy with beans. I have a lot of IgG-related elevated antibodies for many of the other beans, but chickpeas, no bloating, no gas.
At least like in the epidemiological studies, when you see that sometimes like the higher protein intake is linked to mortality, and sometimes it isn't. But what they consistently do find is that the plant-based protein intake is consistently lower mortality risk. Whereas with animal protein, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. With the plant-based proteins, it's generally, obviously there's the risk of the health user bias with the plant-based proteins, that if you're eating beans for your protein, then you probably are more like health conscious as well. But, I think a lot of the biomarkers, you have to kind of experiment and see, okay, how much meat is going to affect my biomarkers? And if you replace it with fish or beans or something like that, how does it improve or decrease the results?
I agree 100%. And along those lines, when I was eating not just sardines every day, but beef and eggs were together, and actually full-fat dairy, which I've taken out all dairy over the past few tests, and the biomarkers have mostly improved. At my most, for animal protein intake, the biomarkers were not at their best. Now, in terms of a healthy user bias there, I was also 10 pounds heavier, probably 10 pounds more fat relative to lean mass. Mm. And I say probably because I don't have DEXA going back 5 years. It's only 2 years of data. So it could be that at my highest animal protein intakes, that extra 10 pounds of fat, maybe that was driving the worst biomarkers. Whereas now, in addition to being leaner, and reducing the animal protein intake, is it the less animal protein or is it the leaner? I don't know.
Yeah, it's also the calorie intake, because I think in some of the studies where people eating more fiber, they have lower BMIs almost in a linear fashion. Like the people who eat the most fiber have the lowest BMIs, and people who eat the least fiber have the higher BMI, at least in cohort studies. So it's, if you're eating more plants, then you're getting less calories from there. Whereas if you are, adding eggs and full fat dairy and meat in there, then, those foods have, twice or three times more calories than vegetables in most cases.
Yeah, 100% agree there too. And I've got a couple things on that. So the first is that doesn't presume that people who are eating almost no fiber can't be lean. And if that's what works best for them, then I'd say go for it, because finding the diet that helps you be at your leanest is probably a big part of this approach. But if that's the only thing you're looking at is leanness as your outcome variable and none of the biomarkers, I'd say to probably expand the approach to just to make sure you know, okay, if eating no fruits and vegetables helps me be satiated, helps me be at my leanest and strongest and all these things and functional, if you're not looking at the biomarkers, then maybe you're just setting yourself up for a, you know, a relatively longer term failure, right? So then the second, but I'm open to that idea. I'm open to the idea of someone, maybe they don't eat any fruits and vegetables and they can stay lean. So along those lines too, right? In my day job, I just submitted a paper yesterday where we fed aged mice standard chow, which is grain-based, you know, oats, corn, and wheat. And then basically the Mike diet, which is paleo-ish. There were no grains. It was fish, nuts, lots of vegetables and fruit, but its soluble fiber intake was 3 times higher than standard chow. Usually when you hear high-fat diet in mice, they're feeding chow as the control diet versus the intervention diet, which is that purified, no real food, and actually it has no fermentable fiber. They give the mice cellulose. So it's a high-fat diet, sure, but it's also soluble fiber-free. So we took the Mike diet and compared it against the standard chow, 3x higher soluble fiber, and the mice ate the same amount of food, and energy density was the same across groups, but the Mike diet got leaner, lost a ton of fat, and improved body composition. So this goes to the like the what you were saying about if you're eating more plants, you know, it's going to be easier to, you know, maintain a lower BMI. Even in old mice, that seems to be the case.
Carbohydrate intake, you've adjusted as well. And, you know, at least in epidemiological studies, like moderate carb intake, something like 40 to 50% is usually linked to lowest mortality. Too high carbohydrate intake can obviously have some, let's say, implications with health that you can expect related to like blood sugar management and things like that. And in the lower carb intake is usually like either reverse causation or something else that, you know, gives that result. So what is your like philosophy with carbohydrate intake? Like how do you adjust it?
Yeah. So actually I started on this journey and even growing up as a teenager, on a very high carb diet, because 40-ish years ago, that was the prevailing view. Eat very low fat. Even like bodybuilder magazines were promoting this thing, like 10% of your calories from fat and then everything else, protein, high protein, and then lots of carbs. So I did that for a very long time, and probably at the detriment to some things like lipoprotein A, which it's related to, you know, cardiovascular disease risk. So mine has always been towards the higher end of the reference range. In tracking that over time, I've seen that on very high carb diets, it's even higher relative to higher fat diets. So my current you know, carb intake of around 40% is based on just following the biomarkers or net carbs. That doesn't include fiber. And that's a part of, you know, like I said, the net biomarkers more in the right direction than wrong, and helping to even control lipoprotein A.
Gotcha. LPA, that's a lot like genetically determined. So how much did your diet affect it? Like, I would imagine it's not a lot you can affect it with diet.
Yeah. So that it's genetically determined and not malleable to any intervention. That's been the prevailing view, published view for a long time. But, you know, remember how hard it is for people to adhere to any kind of dietary intervention, right? So even like an intervention that one group would get 30 grams of fiber and the other group ate 20. I mean, is that enough? Is that enough of a difference, right? Like statistically, you may see differences, you know, in terms of a few variables. But all right, so lipoprotein A for me has been about as twice as high as where it is now. And that's exclusively by diet. I've tried high dose niacin up to 3 grams per day, which has been shown to bring it down in the past. I've tried all kinds of things like the high vitamin C, high lysine, like the Linus Pauling stuff. None of that stuff that's been published to make a dent had worked. In my case, higher fat diets, the higher I go at my highest fat intakes, lipoprotein A has been at its lowest. But there too is that U-shaped curve. If I'm improving lipoprotein A, but glucose is getting worse and a lot of other biomarkers are getting worse, at neutrophils, monocytes, markers of inflammation. Right. So it's finding the bottom of that U-shape where I'm not messing up the rest of the stuff too.
Yeah, like finding a compromise or yeah, like a good balance.
But it's malleable, you know, and that's a big 50% reduction, you know, that's a big cut, you know, and I think any biomarker is malleable. It's just you know, generating enough data and doing enough, following the data, doing enough interventions, and eventually you get to the truth. We'd all love to get to the truth. You do three blood tests and you fix the problem right away. But unfortunately, just some biomarkers, it takes a lot of data generation to get there. And lipoprotein A has been one of those.
Mm. That's very interesting because, so my own lipoprotein A, the recent test was like 3, which is, you know, it's super low, like compared to, I don't know what yours was, but, you know, a lot of people might have anything even up to like 50 or 100 or 300, usually with genetics, but mine was 3, which is, you know, very close to 0. And my diet is like the lowest fat it's ever been, ever. Like I actually eat like more carbohydrates and less fat than ever before. I'm getting maybe like, you know, 20-25% fat, and mostly from like a little bit of olive oil, and mostly from fish is more like most of the fat comes from, and dairy, some of the dairy. And my LP is still like super, like close to 0. Maybe it's so, like genetics.
100%. That's what I was going to say. Likely genetics. My, you know, cardiovascular disease runs in my family. That's probably what wiped everybody out. And just genetically, I'll have higher, even at my lowest, at my highest, it's been like 60 something. At my lowest now, mid 30s, you know, so which still is not terrible, but it's not, you know, almost 0 like yours. But the good news is my ApoB, even with that relatively high lipoprotein A, is relatively low and low risk in terms of all cause mortality.
Yeah. And it just goes to show that you need to test. There's so much individual variance. Like for you, a lower carb and a slightly higher fat intake lower your LPA, whereas for me, my LPA is very low with a low fat and a higher carb intake, yeah, which is kind of funny.
And I don't presume to say, you know, eat my way and you'll have the best health. I don't presume that at all. And I, you know, just not to throw a shot, but I know Brian is selling his Blueprint diet to people. And I think part of what made Blueprint great in the beginning was, you know, he pitched it as this diet gives me my best biomarker profile. What's yours? You know, and now it's morphed in some way into, you know, this diet is best for me and it'll be best for you too, right? So individual tracking is going to be the best thing to determine which diet is best, you know? So, and right. I don't presume it to be my way. For some people it is. For some people, eating a different way is best, but like you said, test and track, and what gets you to your best profile? What's your user's manual for you?
Yeah, that's very true. And carbohydrates and what do you, so like you eat a lot of fiber. So like, what's the rationale for that?
Yeah. So I think the gut, optimizing the gut is probably the most underrated approach for potentially impacting longevity that exists. Mm. And then I can hear the protein crowd saying, again, protein is the muscle, you know, muscle is the longevity organ. We need to eat lots of protein. It's not fiber. I'm not trying to say fiber is better than protein. I'm just trying to say that fiber is underrated. And then there'll be the other side of the coin where people say, you know, the carnivore crowd will say, you don't need fiber at all. Beta hydroxybutyrate is increased on a ketosis. I don't know how they compare. Like you could eat nothing but butter. I don't know how much butyrate you would get and hope that your body converts it into beta hydroxybutyrate. Is that going to be as much as my gut bacteria converting fiber into butyrate? I don't know what the answer is. There's probably, you know, inter-individual variability too. And I don't know about optimizing intestinal barrier function with beta hydroxybutyrate versus butyrate. Sure, they're structurally similar. One just has an OH group, hydroxyl group relative to butyrate. But I haven't seen studies that have looked at gut barrier function with beta hydroxybutyrate versus acetate, propionate, and butyrate, the standard short chain fatty acids. So fiber story is essentially, I'm trying to optimize my, bacteria that produce short chain fatty acids, because that's been shown to optimize gut barrier function, which should lead to less inflammation and, you know, all the things associated with it systemically. So, is it 50 grams the optimal? Is it 80 grams the optimal? I don't know what the optimal number is, but I'm a volume eater too. So the fiber helps with satiety. If I'm not eating a very high fiber diet, it's just hard for me to be satisfied. And the drive to overeat will be more, which would potentially ruin everything, you know, too many calories being bad.
Yeah. Like I haven't like specifically weighed my fiber or counted my fiber, but I would imagine, it's at least 30 grams, maybe 40, I don't think it's like 50 or 60, but maybe 40. But yeah, like, you know, if you eat a lot of fiber, then you're, you know, what kind of foods have fiber? They're mostly like these lower calorie vegetables and plants and fruits and stuff like that. So you're like, it's much easier to adhere to a calorie deficit in that scenario, or to achieve a calorie deficit in the first place, versus, you know, consuming a lot of these higher calorie meals. And, you know, processed foods, they don't have that much fiber at all. So yeah, like, it's a very kind of good heuristic as well for the average person who isn't like fully into tracking and weighing all their food. Like, what is a good way for them to improve their health and biomarkers? It's generally going to be like, you know, weight loss. And the way you achieve weight loss is with a higher fiber and maybe like a slightly higher protein intake as well.
That's generally true. But I should say I have at least one client where the higher fiber approach, and not 80 grams, but just around 40 grams, 30 to 40 grams, they're not satisfied on it and it doesn't help them get leaner. Whereas flipping it the other way and eating almost no fiber helps them be more satiated and helps them lose more weight. But there's still like that titration process where I'm working with them to try to get, you know, at least supplemental fiber in there, knowing it can improve the other biomarkers that may not be, you know, optimizing in conjunction with the weight loss. So it doesn't have to be always high fiber. You know, it's what diet helps you get your leanest. And then is that optimal for all your biomarkers? And if it's not, even Paul Saladino, who is pure carnivore, has modified his approach. And I think, so I made a video, you know, on Paul's biological age when he went on Joe Rogan's podcast. He showed all his blood test data back then. This was like 3-4 years ago. And I mean, his pheno age was like 3 years younger than his chronological, which is insanity. He's lean, you know, he's fit. There's no reason it should be, you know, that small of a deficit. So since then, he's added a whole bunch of stuff here and there. And even Sean Baker, I don't know how I keep talking about carnivore, but Sean Baker said he started eating apples. You know, I don't know if that was because of the lean mass hyper responder stuff and he wants to minimize heart disease risk. I'm not sure what the answer is. But he mentioned he was looking at glucose levels, you know. So it goes back to that idea of whatever diet you're on, just in addition to leanness, just test so that you know, is that truly best for your biomarkers? And if it's not, what can you add? What tweaks can you make to have the net effect on your biomarkers be, you know, as youthful and quote unquote as optimal in terms of all-cause mortality risk as possible?
Yeah, it's like you gotta have like open mind as well as like a kind of agnostic approach to diet and things, because yeah, if you already have a set belief in your head that, hey, this diet is the best without even actually like having measured your biomarkers, then you're just, yeah, like relying on illusions, or you're just having a fantasy in your head that you're like kind of playing some sort of other game that's not related to optimizing longevity and health. Like you're playing a game of belief systems.
But with one exception, if the idea is eat real food and exercise on any diet approach and cut out as much as you can processed foods, I mean, that's probably going to be good for health. But then, as you mentioned, subdividing that diet space into ideologies, like you said, yeah,
for sure.
Need data.
Yeah, you always have to have an open approach to these things. Like, I've changed my diet, I'm probably going to have to change it in some way as well in the future. So it's like, I'm never like, okay, I'm just stuck in my ways and I'm going to do it like that.
Oh, and for people, there are probably people who do that. And then maybe they cherry pick and they say, look at my metabolic health. Yeah, but what about, and I've done this where people say, you know, and I try to stay away from these quote unquote conversations, arguments now, because how do you argue with someone, like you said, who doesn't have an open mind? You know, they'll say, look at my metabolic health. And I'm like, okay, what about the other markers? And then all of a sudden I'm hearing from them again, right? So
yeah, it's like you have one, your diabetes risk is low based on your blood sugar or triglycerides, but diabetes is only the seventh leading cause of death. So it's not like even in the top five. So there's, you know, dozens of other biomarkers that also matter and actually affect the risk.
Definitely. Yeah. But like you said, in terms of being malleable with the approach, you know, sometimes it's not easy, you know, and even having an open mind, like for example, to get eggs into my, or back into my diet, to get that one egg per day back into the diet, I had to get 80 calories from somewhere, right? So dates, I include dates every day. Just, I eat flaxseed. Flaxseed has a net positive score, a correlative score in my data. So, but it's ground, and on its own, I can do flaxseed like that, like maybe a couple days a week. but you know, to consistently do it forever, it's like, you know, in some ways I'm eating sawdust, you know, it's just like wood dust in a way, right? But adding dates now, it's very, you know, it's good, right? So I'm not happy to take out the dates, but I want to do this experiment with eggs back in the approach. So the calories had to come from somewhere. So I had to take dates, you know, out more days than not during the week. So yeah, being married to any dietary ideology, probably not the best way to optimize biomarkers.
Yeah. Where does, so your fiber is like 70 to 80 grams. What kind of foods, where do you get them from? Or do you take any supplement, fiber supplement?
Yeah, no fiber supplements. It's actually 80 to 90 grams now. Average is by 85. The majority is green leafy vegetables. So 420 grams of collard greens per day, 330 grams of beets per day, about 300 grams of carrots per day. So I've got a mix of starchy and non-starchy vegetables there. So those three alone, it's a big chunk of where the fiber comes from. But then also, you know, nuts, flaxseed. I mean, I'm averaging like 25 grams of flaxseed per day. That's a big fiber shot. What else is on my list? Broccoli's in there. The chickpeas are in there. So it all adds up. But the majority are probably from those, and actually red bell peppers. So it's, you know, collard greens, carrots, red bell peppers, and beets are probably the four main ones where I'm getting a big, you know, 40 to 50 grams just from that.
Gotcha. And what about the fats then? Like, what was it? Like 45% fat?
Yeah, that includes fiber though, you know, because fiber being, so it's probably about 36, 37 without the fiber being fermented into short chain. So the fat is almost exclusively from, besides sardines, which have about 20 grams, almonds, walnuts, peanuts, flaxseed, Brazil nuts, pistachios, right? So I've got a mix of all of those, but even how much of those that I'm aiming for, it's, you know, I've got targets for omega-3, I've got targets for omega-6, I've even got targets for saturated fat, which I use coconut butter and cacao beans. So I've got targets for all of that based on the biomarkers that, you know, for some things like omega-6, and this isn't from seed oils, even in my case, too many walnuts, higher omega-6, that's correlated with my liver enzymes looking like I've got, you know, I'm like I'm an alcoholic for whatever reason. I don't know what the mechanism is. ALT, AST move closer to 40 with higher omega-3 intakes correlated. But when I cut my omega-6 back down to about 16 grams per day or less, liver enzymes are about half that. So so I have specific target with the sum of those nuts too, where I have to be careful.
Gotcha. And how much do you, like, do you, how much do you know how much the fiber ferments into the fat?
So it's about 20-ish percent, so of total fiber, that's the estimate. Okay. So for 85 grams of total fiber, about 20% or so of that would be expected to come from soluble fiber. So then it's about 9% from fiber, soluble fiber, that's potentially converted into the short-chain fatty acids. That assumes that I have those bacteria that could ferment fiber into short-chain fatty acids, which may not be totally the case. Some things like bifidobacteria and my gut microbiome are completely absent. But yeah, it would be generally about 20%.
Gotcha. Is there a way for people to, like, you know, obviously, like, it's hard to, like, put into a calculator all your biomarkers and then the data says, like, this is your life expectancy or something like that. But, you know, if someone, people do these tests and stuff like that, how can they know how good are they doing? Like, if they have, let's say, a particular set of lipid markers and inflammation and blood cell markers and stuff like that, how do they know if it's good? How do they know if it's younger than their chronological age? How do they know that it's actually bad and, you know, they're heading in the wrong direction?
Yeah. So I wouldn't focus on the reference range to get that information, because you can be within range and your data changing, either increasing or decreasing, and completely miss an age-related change. The easy answer is I have plans to put this into a book. I've covered a lot of what's optimal in terms of these biomarkers, in terms of how they change during aging and all-cause mortality risk in as large of the epidemiological studies as possible. For example, I don't want to look at a study of, you know, 1,000 people, but if there's only one study on 1,000 people for something like RDW and age-related changes, then the data is what it is. But for example, like albumin, looking at studies of 1 million people or more, And how does that change during aging? And then what's the all-cause mortality risk? So from that, I can make a prediction of what would be quote-unquote optimal, right? Do you want your albumin to be high? Do you want it to be low? How does it change during aging? And then trying to resist that. So a lot of those data are on the YouTube channel. You just search, you know, by keyword for the biomarker. But for the ones that aren't, I plan on putting all that in a book. And then even without that, just using some of these calculators like Levine's PhenoAge, which integrates 9 of those biomarkers, just having a younger biological age relative to your chronological is associated with lower risk of all-cause mortality. And then there's something like for every 1 year increase in PhenoAge, all-cause mortality risk increased by 9%. So even without the specific data on biomarkers, just using simple tools like that has to be better than just doing nothing and guessing.
Right. Do you think these, you know, the PhenoAge, for example, is it a good like umbrella clock or like an umbrella marker? And what I mean is like, if your PhenoAge is good, does it mean that your other like, you know, markers are also predicted to be good, or what, how does it correlate?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways to look at it. One is it strongly correlated with chronological age? And it is. So in 2 separate studies, 0.96, 0.98, as close to 1 in that case would be perfectly linear. So it's as good as the best epigenetic clock, Horvath, for its correlation with chronological age. Now, part of that story is a bit confounded because it has age in a model predicting chronological age. So even if you throw right. that data away, it's associated with all-cause mortality risk, right? And as I mentioned, you know, if you have an older age relative to chronological, it's associated with an increased risk. So so even taking that out, right? And, you know, some people just don't like the QC biological age tests, right? Like if you say, oh, I'm X years younger, right? Okay, even if we throw that away and it's irrelevant, right? Which I don't believe, based on all-cause mortality data. The biomarkers it includes are representative of major organ systems. You've got glucose, you've got creatinine, kidney function, you've got ALP and albumin, liver function, you've got total white blood cells, which isn't perfect. I'd like to see neutrophils and lymphocytes separately, but white blood cells, you've got immune cells there. It's got the RDW, red blood cell related marker. So it's got biomarkers representative of many organ systems. So, yeah, I think it's in, you know, and it's free too, you know, as probably the I don't want to say, you know, use a free clock, you get what you use, right? But it's a good clock, and knowing that it's free, you know, can't lose.
Mm. Yeah, I think there are like some websites that, are there some websites that where you can put the 13 markers and then it's going to do the PhenoAge?
Yeah, the problem there is though, so when PhenoAge was first published, they had an error in their algorithm, and they published a correction that a lot of those email-based websites don't have the corrected PhenoAge algorithm. And it was a simple fix. It wasn't anything crazy, but it's like fixing one number in the algorithm, which if you had the manual download spreadsheet, and I don't want to say I have a link on my website which has the corrected version of PhenoAge, and they can just download it as an Excel file. And they don't have to go and enter your email and get all the spam, you know, that goes with that.
Gotcha. Right. And what were the 30 markers that, or what do you think is the best one then, best of the clocks to your kind of use?
So I don't know best, but PhenoAge is pretty good. There are other clocks that, you know, you can put in like steps per day, glucose, blood pressure, that'll give you an output. That's not bad, but it's just got a few markers. If I remember correct, so I think it's called AnthropoAge. So that one's free too, and pretty easy to use. There's another one that's based on like body size measurements. So like arm circumference, thigh circumference, I think waist circumference and body weight. And that gives you an output biological age. And again, these are trained, you know, in published studies. These aren't just, you know, random questionnaires that, you know, that's how it used to be. So in terms of the blood biomarker, I'd say that PhenoAge is pretty good on its own as a low-hanging fruit without having to look at, okay, I have 30 biomarkers, 25 biomarkers. What's all-cause mortality risk for all of them? It's PhenoAge is easy to use. It's just a simple tool for that.
Yeah, and what were the tests, the markers there?
So albumin, creatinine, CRP, glucose, alkaline phosphatase, white blood cells, RDW, MCV. I'm missing one. CRP? I don't know if I said CRP, but there are nine. There are nine that you enter. Okay.
Age.
And chronological age. Yeah. Yep. And even there, so in NHANES, one of the studies that it was used to derive that model, I think the average pheno age for a study of about 10 or 11,000 people was 5 years younger than their chronological. So if your pheno age is 5 years younger, basically average, that's an average biological age. The question is, though, the maximum reduction using that test is about 20 years younger relative to your chronological. So sure, having, you know, minus 12, minus 9, that's good. It's better than average. But can you improve it to minus 20? And then not just that, can you maintain that every year, right? The challenge there is, even if your biomarkers stay the same, those nine biomarkers stay the same, biological age increases by 0.9 years per chronological year using that clock. So you've got to actually make sure your data is getting better over time. Yeah. But even then, even if you've got 20-year-old biomarkers, you know, there's probably some error in that clock where, you know, like we were saying earlier, if you're 80 and you have those biomarkers literally look like a 20-year-old, it'll say you're 60. But are you really 60 if your biomarkers in that clock on that clock are what you'd find in a 20-year-old? Probably not 60, and you're probably not 20, you know, somewhere in the middle there.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. For sure. There's... Even then, it's, yeah, like, your biomarkers might be good, but your, like, physical function might be worse. So, yeah. Although, you know, if you have good biomarkers, then you probably have, like, some good aspect of physical function and, you know, cognitive function as well.
But to cover that base, like I was saying, if there are blind spots to pheno age, like blood pressure is not included, lung function is not included. Mm. Sure, you've got liver, kidney, immune, inflammation, metabolic status, right? It's got a lot. But I want to cover as many of the organ systems as possible, easily measured organ systems as possible. So 3 days a week, I'm looking at FEV1. I'm, you know, blowing hard, you know, into the spirometer and putting on the cuff, you know, for six measurements within a 30-minute, 15-minute span, just to make sure those things aren't getting worse, you know, over time too.
And you're measuring it like every day or?
3 days a week. I could get carried away, but, you know, 3 days a week, I think, you know, it becomes a measure of how many days a week do you need to track some of these things to have, you know, an accurate representation of where your data really is, right? It's like for the people who blood test once a year, is one blood test representative of a full year's worth of data? You know, what's the variability every couple of months?
How often, or what are the things that you do then every day, like your resting heart rate, sleep, steps, or calories, or?
I don't track steps, but I track the average daily heart rate, which is probably a better measure relative to steps. Is, you know, if you walk 1,000 steps on a flat plane versus 1,000 step up a hill, it's still 1,000 steps, but one of those is going to be a higher heart rate. Yeah. So resting heart rate variability, average daily heart rate, total sleep stages, everything in the diet, everything is weighed, nighttime room temperature, body weight.
Gotcha. Sounds good. And then you do like how often do you do blood tests then? Like how, every few months?
Seven times a year is my, actually I did it 8 times last year. But when I do the blood testing, it's the standard chemistry, you know, complete metabolic panel, those basics, CRP, that's at least seven times per year. And then on the same day as those tests, I've added in the epigenetics, metabolomics, NAD, but then sporadically throughout the year, I'm still working on optimizing things in my oral microbiome. So at least for those foundational tests right now, it's 7 times per year. If I have a specific test, or intervention that I want to do, sometimes I'll move it up. Like some of the NAD tests, I think I tested 15 times last year in a 12-month span, but I'm trying different interventions outside of, you know, big picture, which is, you know, the 7 blood tests per year.
Gotcha.
I work with a client who tests 12 times per year. So there are people more crazy than me with this stuff.
Nice. Yeah, well, it's been really awesome talking with you again and going into all the details. You know, at least I love it. And I hope that people who watch it also like it. But where can people learn, you know, more about your stuff, and how can they, like, try to, if they want to implement something like the, what you're doing in terms of what blood tests to do and how do they, like, you know, actually know their biomarkers and health, where can people learn that info?
Yeah. So the YouTube channel is Conquer Aging or Die Trying. Actually, at all of my social media stuff is Conquer Aging or Die Trying. For any information on biomarkers, just, you know, they'd come, go there and do a search or hit me up in the comments or send me an email, tweet at me or message. You know, I try to be very available to try to help as many people as I can, you know, on the journey, on a similar journey. So, but how about the LDL, the need and pace correlation? You want to see that? Or we save that for another time?
Yeah, I mean, we can, yeah, for sure add it in. Like, people don't know the backstory, but you can talk about it, or you can make an introduction about it.
All right. So the goal is to have an epigenetic pace of aging, Dunedin pace value, that's as slow as possible, 0.6, right? So the first thing is, it's harder to maintain a youthful Dunedin pace as you get older, because that increases during aging too. So my data has been an average around 0.81, which is better than expected based on chronological age, but it's not as young as guys like you, Joe Cohen, people who are 10 to 15 years younger, you know, chronologically, right? So how can I get, and now granted, Brian Johnson's now, I guess he's reached, you know, where you guys are, and he's a bit older chronologically. So, but he's throwing 100 different supplements, like kitchen sink. He's hitting it with everything, right? I'm not doing that. I try the opposite approach, right? How can I change my diet and overall strategy? So the first thing I look at is correlations with diet. You know, as I mentioned, I track diet every day. Every blood test has a corresponding diet intake. So I have 13 tests for Dunedin pace, and I've looked at correlations. And unfortunately, nothing meets the significance threshold with a p-value less than 0.05, which is just the basic threshold. It's nothing crazy. So it seems like I'm out of luck. How am I going to improve Dunedin pace if nothing is significant? So then I did a biomarker versus biomarker analysis, meaning on the same day as those 13 tests, I also sent, you know, blood for analysis for all of the other stuff that I do. So how does that correlate, and is there a story there? So when I do that, and I'll share screen. Let's see here. So one of the four significant correlations, again, with that p-value less than 0.05, is LDL. And not the way maybe some people would expect. With this correlation here, so we've got Dunedin pace value on the y-axis plotted against LDL. These are my 13 days of data. So here it says significant inverse correlation is what we can see with that correlation coefficient, the p-value at 0.05. In other words, the higher my LDL within the 83 to 62 range, 62 to 83, the lower the epigenetic pace of aging, which then goes to the question of, is too low for LDL potentially bad? And I'll get to that in a second. But it also goes to, I don't want to have an LDL of 190, which has been shown, you know, in primary prevention studies, even not just the epidemiological observational, to be associated with an increased cardiovascular disease risk. So, you know, how high can I go where it's safe, where I keep my CHD risk low, while potentially also slowing my epigenetic pace of aging? So that's one reason why I've added actually eggs back into the diet and increased my saturated fat levels by a bit to try to push my LDL into this zone to test this hypothesis. And then in terms of how high can I go for LDL, if this is a real association, if it's not just correlation, that goes to heart disease risk, right? So this is probably the best data that I've come across for the association for LDL with heart disease mortality risk. And the reason I say that is because a lot of these studies don't account for reverse causation by adjusting their model for literally every disease that can affect this association. So for example, in the minimally adjusted model, you know, age, sex, race, and smoking status, you can see how the curve looks for an LDL of 120. It would be associated with a 20% lower risk of heart disease mortality. But in the second model, when adjusting for more factors, including statin use, BMI, hypertension, diabetes, now you can see that that risk is only 10%. So those variables can impact the association for LDL with heart disease mortality risk. But when you further adjust for literally almost every reverse causation related disease, including heart disease, AFib, heart failure, I mean, these are the standards, but where it goes above and beyond is liver disease, kidney disease, lung disease, cancer, depression, and dementia. Most of the LDL-based studies and looking at heart disease risk don't adjust for the all of these, only some. And when you include those covariates, now you can see that 120 is not associated with a, with an increased heart disease mortality risk, whereas levels higher than that are. Okay, so now we're talking about what's the lower limit, and you can see that, you know, so the shaded green region is above one, which suggests that anything lower than 65 could be associated with increased heart disease risk. Now, to take it back to where my data is, if you notice, my worst epigenetic pace of aging is, granted, it's two data points at that level, but one of them is my worst data ever, and the other is, you know, not great either. So this is just another way of showing that, you know, we can use multiple biomarkers to try to get at what is the optimal LDL outside of what published data shows.
Yes, I mean, even then, like, you know, 65 is like astronomically low for most people, and even 85 is lower than, like, you know, 90% of people. So even then, you're still like in the 99 percentile of people with the lowest LDL, if that makes sense. So yeah, like, you have a lot of room to kind of experiment and see how it affects the results, so to say. And, you know, and maybe like the, maybe like the calorie intake or whatever, like some other things can also like affect that. So it's, yeah, interesting. And of course, you know, which one would you think is more important in terms of the evidence, like the dunedin pace or the other like cardiovascular disease markers, so to say? Like, you have to kind of, yeah, think about which ones, which one have more data and which one are like more important to kind of focus on for whatever person.
But they could both be important though in separate mechanisms, right? And, and, you know, so this is just correlation for now, right? If I push my LDL to 100, 95, 110, and I start to see Dunedin pace come down to 0.7, 0.6, you know, knowing that that LDL range was 65 to 120, I can still technically stay safe within that, you know, heart disease mortality risk range, while also keeping my Dunedin pace, you know, my epigenetic pace of aging as low as physically possible. So,
yeah, for sure.
But imagine if I didn't look at that, right? And, you know, I went by this idea of lower is always better for LDL, which is, there is some prevailing view. I mean, a lot of lipidologists, you know, that's what they'll, if you have heart disease, I buy that 100%. I don't, as far as I know right now, I don't have heart disease, right? So, but yeah, it just goes to that idea of, you know, how can I optimize multiple biomarkers by, you know, looking at them all as opposed to only focusing on it isolation, and then missing potentially a big, you know, part of the story, epigenetic pace of aging.
Yeah. Well, this is a good little bonus in the end. But yeah, Conquer Aging or Die Trying on YouTube, and people can check it out. I'll put the link in the description as well. And yeah, it's been great talking with you. We can certainly, or we will probably do like more episodes in the future once your data changes or once your approach changes as well.
Cool. Thanks, Seem.
All right. I'll see you around. Other than that, thanks for watching this video. Make sure to click a like and subscribe. My name is Seem. Stay optimized, stay empowered.